Welcome to the Pilates Progressions Program. I'm Katrina Fo, your host for tonight, and I'm excited to be with you and help you discover more and more understanding in the body as you work with your clients and help to deepen your understanding of Pilates and how to cue and how to help people enjoy movement. So tonight, we've got quite a few questions. Some of them are left over from last week. We didn't get to everything, which is fine. I know you guys are excited to hear the answers, so we will get to it. I haven't been, I didn't mention last week, but we had the chair workshop, the chair training module, last weekend, and then this weekend we have the barrels and small apparatus. And that's going to be it's one day on Saturday. And I will say that if you take the barrels and small apparatus module, Balanced Body has kind of two versions of it. One of them is just barrels, and that's what most people offer. And then if you add the small apparatus, people are offering, you know, like the magic circle and the foot corrector and, you know, some the pedipole and some things like that. But we also have included the armchair. It is a classical piece of Joe's Pilates equipment that most people don't have, most people haven't seen, but it's actually a really cool piece of equipment. And the instructors at our studio were trained by Julian Littleford himself on it, who he has done a lot of training on it and has some different training manuals. And we have one, so we include it in our training. So, again, if you're going to take that module, I highly recommend taking it with us because you get more bang for your buck. It is a little bit more expensive, and there are obviously more teaching hour time in the module, but that's because you get more content. So we cover everything from the breathalyzer to the, the bean bag, the toe corrector, you know, all those little guys, and what Joe actually had us doing with him, the neck corrector, what else, you know, we talk about all these things. So just a reminder, we do offer that three times a year, and this Saturday is one of them. So sign up through Balanced Body if you're interested, and hopefully we'll see you there. I will just remind everyone, we did have a question, I don't know, a week or two ago about the toe corrector, and I don't know if you noticed, but she mentioned in there, I wrote all this stuff down in the training, but I didn't practice it right away, and now I've forgotten it, .. So please, please remember that when you take these modules, whether it's on the small equipment or the large equipment, that you go over all your material. The research shows that if you go over it within 24 to 48 hours, you have a much, much higher retention rate. And just from personal experience, if you don't go over it within, you know, several hours versus days, you're never going to use it. It'll just float away into what I call Pilates Never Never Land, and you will not see it again. And it goes so far as to, I've had several people, many, many people over the years, they come back for their test out, and they want to do a couple privates to, you know, brush up and ask questions before they do the test outs, and that's all great. And they come and they're like, you know, I don't think we covered this in the module, and they're pointing to some exercise in the manual. I'm like, yes, we always cover everything in the manual, but it's because they didn't go over it. And that's one of the big things that I emphasize with the P3 program is I want that to not to happen. So we make sure if you work the program through P3, you will not allow that to happen to yourself because you will get everything in the Balanced Body program covered, as well as 150 extra exercises, you know, just for good measure. That's because I really enjoy all the different modifications and variations and the wide variety of stuff you can do with Pilates equipment, and that's something that I really enjoy. So we've put that into the Pilates Progressions program to reflect that. If you have any questions about making sure that doesn't happen to you, let me know, but my usual thing to encourage people is that get into the studio, you know, that Monday morning and get some self-practice hours in and just, you know, go over everything that you did in the workshop and just do it again. The night after the workshop or the next morning, so for us it's usually like a Saturday night or Sunday morning kind of a thing, go over your notes. And even if you're just reading over your notes, make sure you understand what your notes say. Make sure that you kind of mentally imagine what that was and the choreography of it in your head, so it's clear. And you don't even have to get on the equipment, okay, because usually you're pooped out and tired and possibly sore. If it's a two-day module, the barrels isn't, but I highly recommend that after the first night, I know you're tired, I know you just took a long a test probably, but go over it and make sure that you have any questions or holes in your notes kind of starred or whatever to ask the next day. I can't tell you how many times people don't even look over their notes. And the people that are really going to get the most out of it are the ones that are getting over the, looking over the notes and then take that opportunity to ask questions. If you look over your notes in the bear, you know, in the chair module, and then you have a question, you can always come back and at another module and ask a question, especially at a break or something. That's a great time as well. But it's always good to get it while you're there, right when it's fresh in your mind on the second day if you can. So those are just some tips. I'm going to jump right into the questions now because we have some good ones. All right, so I mentioned this one last week. I alluded to it, a little teaser for you. This girl wrote, "Hi, Katrina. I was watching a Pilates Anytime video with the jump board. During the jump board exercises, the instructor said to bend your knees only as far as you can keep your heels down on the board. I tried this, and my knees barely bend. I realized my Achilles isn't very flexible. Is it just the Achilles tendon that's not flexible, or are there other muscles involved in my inability to keep my heels down? I know the tendon stretch, reformer slush chair, Achilles stretch chair, and footwork like running on the reformer stretch this, but are there other exercises that help as well?" And then she also wrote, this is kind of like a second question that I'll answer probably afterwards. I know you're supposed to, quote, roll through the foot on the jump board, but I don't understand why and which way, heel toe or toe heel. How do we roll through the foot when we walk or run? I've seen people who look like toe walkers and others that are noticeably strike their heel first. I don't really understand the mechanics behind it. Is it heel to toe when we walk and toe to heel when we jump on the jump board and running? Thank you for the help." Okay, so these are excellent questions and things that you are definitely not alone in being confused by. The jump board, first off, I want to mention, is not an authentic piece of Pilates equipment. Lolita has given me on good authority that it was a Romana invention. Not that that's bad. It's an awesome invention. I just think it's kind of humorous historically that, you know, Romana always touted that she, you know, only did classical, you know, the what Joe did, but that wasn't a Joe thing. Lolita said that was never a Joe thing. It's very dancer-like, and it has a lot of amazing applications in rehabbing dancers or athletes from, you know, working on, you know, a ballerina that had a ankle sprain, and you can actually get them on there and actually do point work on there and all sorts of different bar work and everything and get really, really detailed and gradually add more springs to mimic having more standing body weight. But because you're lying down, you can change that. Versus, you know, somebody like a basketball player, say they have a rolled ankle, or, you know, they sprain their ankle kind of thing. You can, again, do the same thing and mimic the jumping mechanics and really work on these, you know, mechanics with less stress on the joint because there's you have gravity taken out of it because you're lying down. And so you can put more springs on to make it harder and harder. Or, you know, if they haven't had an injury, you can be working on building power and making sure that the detailed mechanics of the gait is perfect, that their alignment is perfect to make sure that there's not any wear and tear excessively on the joints and such and build power. So you can do it either way. You can focus on like an injury or you can focus on just performance. Both are excellent. Okay, so with the jump board exercises, this is really important. You want to make sure that you are getting good mechanics, that you understand what good mechanics are and that you understand what you're doing. So when you bend your knees only as far as you can keep your heels down, what she's doing is she's trying to mimic how you use your legs when you are standing. So most people, if you think about, you know, being upright and you're going to jump, you don't bend your knees so far that your heels come off. Okay? So that's where that comes from. And because it is an area that tends to be very inflexible, if you let the heels come off, you're avoiding that stretch. And that's probably what you noticed right away that might have been different than if you've done the jump board in other ways. So if you allow your heels to come off, you're allowing your body to kind of sidestep the really good stretch and the work that needs to happen in that area. So it's a great cue, especially if people are tight there, which I probably say most people are tight. However, another way of looking at it, if you want to get a really deep bend, you know, say you want to work on full range of motion of that ankle and knee joint or something, you know, my cue then changes to make sure that your heels touch down at some point in the jump on the way off and on the way down. Okay, a lot of people, what you'll notice when they're jumping, their heel never touches. And that, to me, is my biggest pet peeve because it has to touch at some point. Otherwise, you're missing the point of the jump board. You're training them in bad mechanics of the leg. If you watch people when they're doing those jump board classes or workouts where they're on the jump board for, you know, more than like 10, 15 minutes, which is unfortunately really common, especially when they're trying to get cardio, everybody's just kind of flopping around. Their legs and knees and ankles are all over the place and stuff. And this is one of the biggest things that I harp on. So whether you keep them down and you never let them come off, or whether you get more full range of motion and, you know, let them come off, but they have to go down at some point, that's up to you, based on what you think that client needs. Now, you're going to love this part. If you were my client, I would make you do it the way this other instructor said and keep your heels down, and that's as far as you get to go. Why? Because that's obviously what you're not good at, and that's what you need to practice at. Again, there might be other range reason to do the full range of motion later, but I would first work on that place that you've obviously seen this muscle imbalance. Now, you mentioned some different exercises, so the tendon stretch, Achilles stretch, and things like that, and I'm going to talk about those. But first off, I just want to mention, you wrote, my Achilles isn't very flexible, and is it just the Achilles tendon that's not flexible, or are there other muscles involved? Okay, so I think you already know this probably, but I just want to clarify for everybody out there that the Achilles tendon is the connective tissue between the muscle and the bone. And so you don't want connective tissue to be flexible. It isn't flexible. It's a set length, and you pretty much want to keep the integrity of that the same. What you want to change the flexibility of and the resting length of are the muscles that attach to it. And I think you know that. You were just wording it in a kind of slang way, because most people talk about the Achilles in that kind of way. I just want to make sure, because we're talking about the anatomy, that we're crystal clear, especially since I don't have pretty pictures to point to. Okay, so the muscles that would be tight would be the gastrocnemius, usually just slang the gastroc. This has got two heads, so you've got one that goes up the outside and one that goes up the inside of the calf, and again, they come down and attach to that Achilles tendon, otherwise known as the calcaneal tendon. Also, the plantaris, that muscle attaches on the outside of the femur. The femur. So up higher, and it attaches in the same tendon. And then the soleus also attaches into the same tendon. So they all merge together and share the Achilles tendon together. Okay, and that happens several times in the body. You've got the quads that all four of them merge and attach into that same tendon that envelops your kneecap and everything. So the soleus, I didn't say that, it starts up on the outside of the tibia and the fibula, so it's not quite as far-reaching, but you've got different angles on that, all pulling on the Achilles. So it could be any of those that are tight, causing the tension in your Achilles. So it could be gastroc, could be plantaris, could be soleus, it could be all of them. But basically, it's the muscles that are going to point your ankle. So that openness at the front of the ankle is what we're talking about. That's going to pull the heel, the calcaneus, that heel bone, towards the back of your calf. Okay, so it's going to shorten that Achilles part. That motion, that movement is what these muscles do. And so that is tight. It may be strong, I don't know. And that's what's causing it so that you aren't able to open that fully in the back to get that heel to stay on as you really move into that plantar flexion of the foot. So the movement you're looking for is plantar flexion. And I know it's really confusing at the ankle because they're both called flexion. So plantar point dorsiflexion is the what we typically call flex. And so just to clarify with those terms, you can think PEP, plantar flexion of the ankle, is the technical term. Pointing is what we usually call the what you do at your ankle there. So the movement of pointing the foot, those muscles need to be lengthened, and those are what's tight on you. And again, I can't tell specifically which one, but they, because they all attach to the Achilles, it could be any one or multiple ones of them. And so your job is to stretch that. And the muscles that you mentioned, the exercises that you mentioned, the tendon stretch, Achilles stretch, footwork on the running and things, are great. Those are awesome. The tendon stretch, I don't know that it's really the best in terms of really actively stretching it and getting that open, but it's working in that lengthened position. And most people have such a hard time getting the deep posterior tilt of the pelvis, and they start to almost like point their toes to kind of help themselves get that. And so you'll notice that cheat. And as a teacher, it's really easy to see if they're having a hard time with that and weaken that area, because you see it in their feet and they lose that stretch there. But I don't know if I'd pick that exercise specifically to stretch it, because they can get out of it really, really easy and avoid that stretch. It's a little tricky to see that. The Achilles stretch in the chair is a great one, as well as the running footwork. And you can give some little assistance on the footwork. Have them drop one heel down, and you can pull their ankle down. You can, like, lean your whole body weight into it, and I've never had anyone it be too much. They just go, ah, like you just, you know, gave them a massage or something. It's fabulous. You can do this on your own as well if you use your other foot to pull the bar towards you. That might take some brain power to think about. So you drop one heel under the bar when you're doing your footwork, and then you take the other foot, put your heel on top of the bar, and kind of bend that knee to pull your carriage in to draw the foot bar towards you, and that'll get that stretch in the back of the calf as if someone's assisting you. And I mention that because I use that myself when I am working out, because there's not usually someone there to do it for me. And I'm pretty sure you have a piece of equipment at your home, so that might be an issue for you personally. Also, if you're working in a class setting, if you cue people through that and they know that, they really love that. And that way you don't have to, like, have everybody sit there while you go around and give them a little assistance stretch each, you know, it's too much. But a lot of people, that's a really great thing. So other things you can do. The biggest thing that I would say is actually one that you're not even thinking of. And so any time that you want to stretch a muscle, and open that up, the best and most effective way to do it is not these stretchy exercises. And that's what everyone goes to usually. It's the work of the opposer exercises. So what you want to do is say, okay, the back of the calf, to be general, working is what's causing, they're too tight, so I don't get that stretch opening up. So what I want to do is flip it and work the opposite, the front of the shin muscles, and that's what needs the strength to be able to pull me into that as well and open that up. And that is an area that so many people are weak at. And here's a couple places it'll show up. So if you're doing, say, roll-up, watch them and see if they can keep their feet flexed during it. Okay, plain, ordinary mat roll-up. Have their feet flexed, put their toes together, knees together, and all that stuff. And most people, in about 2 seconds after saying that, their feet will angle so that if you're looking down as the teacher on their feet, their toes are like the point of a triangle and their pinky toes are the wide base. If you drew a triangle, it wouldn't be a flat, straight line anymore. And so that's some weakness in that, especially the outside, the lateral side of that, the shin muscles, as well as when you do the short box series. Most people hold the rope with their toes, not at their ankle. And I'm sure you've all heard me yap about making sure the strap is at the ankle, not the toes. This is why. This is why, because the front of those shin muscles, that tibialis anterior in particular, are very, very weak for a lot of people, and that, again, it shows up a lot of times when they're tight in the back of their calves. People work their calf muscles all the time, and you know, people are always doing heel lowers and all stuff because, why? Calves look pretty when they're nice and firm and lifted up, right? Who cares about the front of their shins? That's not sexy, right? So nobody does any work on that. Again, that's aesthetic training, and that is not what we do in Pilates. We work on the muscle imbalances, and so in this particular person is pointing out that there's a muscle imbalance going on at the ankle joint. The back side is too tight. I haven't heard from her whether the front side is too weak, but I'm going to guess because, again, they work together in opposition. And so if you work the front side, it will lengthen out the back side. Sneaky stretching, that's what I call it. And sneaky stretching, you don't feel stretching. And so if you're working with a client, you need to explain this concept to them. This is your value-adding statement, because they don't think you're doing flexibility training. However, you are doing way better actual accomplishment of changing the resting length of the muscles than passive stretching. Passive stretching, yes, they get sore the next day. Yes, they might relax into it that day and see something, which, again, people buy into as actually doing something, but it doesn't actually change. A month later, nothing's going to be different. Whereas with this type of stretching, the sneaky stretching, they don't feel anything at the time, which people would say they like, but they don't feel like they're doing something. So you need to make sure you add the value. And it's very long-term in terms of it stays that way. It's not just, you know, that day. It's, you know, it stays the next day, and it's just your body changes. And so that's what we're talking about, the resting length, what your body naturally goes to without having to be warmed up, without having to coax it into that and release into that. It's where it is normally, and that's what our main goal is. Okay, so work the front of those shins. How do you do that? One of my favorite is an exercise. It's not a classical one, but it's in the balanced body repertoire because it's an issue. So you have the dorsiflexion work with the push-through bar loaded from the top. It's done from the position of the parakeet feet in that series, and you can do that just, you know, right afterwards. Great exercise. I really, really like just focusing my attention on that when I do short box. Okay, so just holding onto that strap, huge, 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 huge. I want those toes, especially those pinky toes, to be pulled back to the kneecaps, and I don't want them to lose it, not only because of safety. Okay, probably a lot of you thought that was just because of safety. It is a safety feature, but it's really great work for the front of the shins. Let's see. Also, I do a lot of work, if it's a mat exercise or anything where your feet are not in a closed chain, so they're not on something, you're not standing on them, or they're against a bar or anything like that, they're just loose, add some flexion to the feet, to the ankles, rather, and work on that. You know, not just the you know, toes, but the whole foot, pulling the whole thing back, and it should be even across, a whole straight line from your pinky toes to your big toes. So again, like I mentioned before, my example, the roll-up is a great one, but I mean, you can do that on the saw, the spine twist, I mean, tons of different exercises. You can do it, you know, on chair work if you're doing mermaid with your legs straight out in front of you. You could do it, you know, if you're doing side arms or something, anything where your legs, you're not using your feet, you can just layer that on there. So you can do that several times. You don't need a whole lesson plan of that, but layering that on several times will really make a big difference quick. And again, they don't even feel the stretching. So if you add that in with some of these exercises like Achilles stretch, you can really have some great work with that. Okay, now onto the second part of your question. You were talking about rolling through the foot on the jump board. I'm just going to go through the basic mechanics. You can take whole courses on gait mechanics. It is a very, very in-depth subject, and there are so many reasons why the gait can be thrown off, whether it's because your weight is distributed differently, like in pregnancy, or if you become overweight, or just aging. A lot of times, you know, you see the old man shuffle. My mom always yells at my dad, don't do that old man shuffle. Stand up straight. Do your Pilates. But there's also a lot of different things, conditions like Parkinson's or different schizophrenia or different things that alcoholism that will take a toll on your body and cause it to have different specific gait patterns. There's lots of different gait abnormalities, and this is a huge thing that people will look into and look at different neuropathies and such. That's going to be way beyond the scope of this little question, but I want you to know the basics of what a heel to toe gait pattern should be. So normal, that's what we're talking about. It should strike, heel, and roll through to the toe as you're walking. And I'm going to talk about how that pertains to the jump board and everything, because it's always the same. So if you are taking a step, the leg that swings forward should touch the floor with the heel first. You should imagine the sole of your foot. There's lots of little joints in there because there's multiple bones. It's not like one bone. I'm sure you've all seen a foot skeleton and how there's lots of little bones. Think of it like a spine. So you are going to think of articulating or rolling through the foot. That's what they're saying, is, you know, like a roll-up. Think of it like articulating through your foot, just like you'd articulate through your spine. You want all those joints to move. So as you touch the heel down, then you're going to roll through those little joints all the way to the tops of your toes. And as at this point in your gait, your other foot's forward and the leg we're talking about is back behind you as the foot is coming off the ground, to then swing forward and start by touching the heel strike and touch the heel on the floor. And then as your weight is on it, you're rolling through, and then the heel comes off first, and then you're rolling through all the way till your toes come off last. Now, in terms of relating it to the jump board and running and just jumping, standing and such, this should be the same thing. The awkward thing and unusual thing about the jump board is that you're seeing lots of different phases. So imagine somebody's standing still. Now, the jump board is fabulous because you get to slow motion what a jump looks like. You can go real slow, especially if you do like just a red and a blue spring or something kind of light. So if they're standing straight-legged, heels, whole foot on the board, their first thing with a jump is they do the preparation. They bend their knees, and like we talked about a second ago, keep the heels down would be like if you were standing on earth. And then when you bend your knees and you push off, your heel is obviously, hopefully, going to be the first thing off, and you roll through that foot till your toes peel off. Then as you come back down, slow motion, your toes should be the first thing that touch, and you roll through the foot till your heel touches. You bend your knees and keep that heel on, and then you straighten the legs, lift the heel, roll up through the toes. Okay, so when you're jumping, it is a little different mechanic because the first thing that touches the ground should be the toes, not the heel. Okay, so it's opposite, if you will. But it should be the same on the jump board as it is in regular daily life. Now, running is just a fast version of walking. Okay, it should be, at least. And again, if you have weird mechanics in your gait, your normal gait, they're going to show up in your running. And if somebody is running, especially a distance runner, those are going to be compounded, and most likely they're going to end up having some problems because the gait is off a little bit. So that's why it's very, very important to watch their walk. And I don't recommend doing this while people are, like, trying to walk right and stuff, but you can just watch them as they walk around the street. Here, go get some water, and you're watching them. And then you're going to get to see what they really do versus the arbitrary, I'm going to do a gait analysis on you today. I'm going to sit here with my notepad and now walk over there. Oh, my goodness, you're getting something very artificial. That's not how they usually walk. Most people don't know enough to know how ideal walks should be, but they know enough to try to mimic whatever they do think it is. So I like to do it when they're not looking and they're not trying. Hopefully that helps. In terms of some of the things you'd mentioned about people like who are toe walkers, again, that's probably going to be somebody that does not have the length in the back of their calf, like you mentioned. So that might be you. I doubt it. But that would be a more extreme case of what you're talking about you have. It could be somebody that's used to wearing high heels and that Achilles and all those muscles attached to it are noticeably shorter because they've been wearing high heels all the time and they're not used to lengthening that out. It should get that heel strike first. Some people smack their heel, and again, that's not good. We want it to look organic and smooth. And innately, most people know what looks right. Okay, that's a good thing because you've watched people. People can walk on the outside of their feet, on the inside of their feet, on their toes, on their heels where their toes never touch, all sorts of different things. But again, it should, as your heel strikes forward, it should have, now there's lots of different angles and aspects of the gait phases and such. But the leg that is striking and touching the ground, the heel should touch first. As you put your weight on it, the whole foot is flat, and then as the leg reaches behind you, the heel comes off first and then all the way through to the toe, and then the leg swings forward to take another step. So we're just looking at the one leg, and so hopefully that clears some stuff up. Again, when you're working on the jump board, have them go slow. Explain to them what you want. Usually I start with keep your heels down, do some pliés. So just bending and straighten the knees. And then I'll have them do some relevés. So they start to lift their heels a little bit after their legs are straight. And then as they bend their knees, their heels stay down. And they lift all the way up. And even if they aren't a ballerina, especially if they want to do any jumping or if they do a sport that does any jumping, I'll have them roll all the way up onto the tops of their toes. Because there are muscles actually behind the toes, there's quite a few of them actually, that will push off. And those are so, there's so much power in those muscles for jumping. It's super important. So it's not like you're training them to do point work and be a ballerina, but if you get those muscles in the back of their toes really strong, it can really help. You know, think something like a basketball player. They don't think you're retarded trying to have them stay on the tops of their toes, but those muscles, it's a great way to really work them and isolate them and really work on that. So you want to work through that. And you should, if you were videotaping it, see all that happening in slow motion as they do a jump. They should roll through that and then roll through it back again. That's one of the big problems, that if people don't keep their abs engaged when they're doing jump board work, their legs kind of lower a little bit. And if they touch their toes down first, they'll kind of roll over their toes and kind of land on their knuckles and have to bend their knees and all this weird stuff because they didn't hold their legs up and they weren't rolling through their feet. But they were getting their toes to touch first, which is what you wanted. So they just need to keep their legs up a little better. Okay, so those are some thoughts. Please email me back and let me know if that answers your question, because that was a really open question and I want to make sure I got every aspect of it because there's so many things we could talk about there. Okay, I'm going to go on to the next question. This is a big one. She wrote, "Hello again. I was wondering if you've heard of prolotherapy. I had a client who tried it for her sciatica pain, and she said the pain is pretty much gone. The physician said she had bursitis in her left hip, which was causing the pain. He did an ultrasound to find the bursitis and then injected it with whatever solution they use and a bit of cortisone. Apparently, it's worked wonders for this pain and also for her knee pain years ago when she had a knee replacement. I was just curious as to what you think about it." Well, first off, I want to have a big disclaimer. I am not a doctor. I don't do these injections. I'm sure that there are several of you out there that know way more about this than I do, but I just want to give you the basics so that you can be educated. So prolotherapy is also sometimes called proliferation therapy or regenerative injection therapy, and basically they're going to inject a ligament or a joint space or a tendon with an irritant solution, and that's going to help relieve the pain. Why would that help relieve the pain, you may ask? Because it's an irritant. Well, the idea is that it's going to cause irritation, which will then stimulate your body to produce different enzymes and hormones that will help encourage healing, that will elicit and make your body start healing. So things like encouraging, you know, blood flow, new blood vessel formation, your immune system in general, protein synthesis, all these kinds of stuff is very, very helpful to the healing process and the, you know, regrowing connective tissue and lay down new collagen fibers. All this stuff is needed in the healing process. So if your body maybe isn't doing it itself, you can stimulate it to heal by causing it to release the hormones and stuff that you need to get those healing properties going. So that's the thought behind it and how it works. Now, cortisone is kind of the opposite. Cortisone is suppressing the immune system and actually deteriorates the connective tissue. It's a steroid hormone, and it's a hormone that's released in the adrenal glands in our body, and you know, probably synthetic, what they're injecting and all that stuff. But it's used to suppress the immune system. So it's, again, a steroid, and it reduces inflammation that way. It reduces the pain and the swelling at the site of the injury. However, there is a drawback. Usually cortisone works really well if they get it at the right place. And I say that because a lot of times they don't get it at the right place and people don't feel anything. It's very, very common to have clients that have cortisone injections and they don't feel anything. I'm going to read a list of some different things that they have shown in studies to be side effects or issues, problems with cortisone. So first off, cortisone injections are very short-lived, so it wears off. It can actually damage the cartilage and joints, especially people that have osteoarthritis in the joint. It has negative effects on the soft tissue by inhibiting the blood flow to the area, new blood vessel formation and collagen formation and things. It actually will weaken the collagen and therefore the soft tissue, meaning the ligaments and tendons. That's scary. It causes bone death. It inhibits the release of growth hormones, which further decrease soft tissue and bone repair. It can lead to painful tendon and ligament ruptures. Okay, because think about it, the soft tissues and tendons and ligaments have been deteriorated. It can deteriorate the joint. Nothing has been shown to deteriorate a joint quicker than cortisone shots, unless you like went in with for arthroscopy with the cartilage meniscus shaving. So your risk of needing joint replacements is a lot higher. It's basically poison to the connective tissue of your body, including cartilage, muscles, ligaments, meniscus, tendons, all that kind of stuff. It can predispose you to joint infections and will cause degeneration, which eventually will lead to surgery or injuries and such. So if you can't tell, I'm a little biased against cortisone. I know they work in terms of people feel better right then. But the negatives to me are so not worth it. Now, you mentioned that your client, they did an ultrasound to find the bursitis, so they found the spot specifically, which is awesome, because like we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, there's lots of different bursas in the hip joint, so you want to make sure you get the right one and you get it exactly when you're injecting it. Now, you also mentioned that they did the prolotherapy and cortisone, and I'm really confused about that. To me, they seem to kind of work in opposition to each other. So I am not sure. Maybe the cortisone is what's causing her to not have the pain right away. Maybe it's the prolotherapy. I don't know. But I would not think that that would be very effective because you're kind of, I don't know. Maybe the person's just putting both out there and see what works. But a lot of times, you know, it's like working with essential oils and homeopathy. You know, they work in they don't work together. You don't want to use both. And so, you know, they're different systems, they're different ways of working. You don't just want to throw everything at the same thing. That, to me, is the confusing part. I'm not going to give my personal opinion, but that seems very bizarre and confusing. I think prolotherapy sounds like it's got some really great positives to it. The greatest thing is that people can keep training while you're receiving the treatments. It's not putting you at a risk for more injuries and stuff. It's going to stimulate the repair of the injured tissue, as will exercise. Exercise stimulates the blood flow, the circulation, and that's going to encourage, you know, all the different things that we talked about with prolotherapy. So, you know, what's the first thing people tell you to do when you get injured? You know, ice it, make it stop, and don't work out. Well, like, yeah, but if you don't move your body and get the circulation going, things get worse real fast. Your body needs that to heal. So if you have an ankle sprain, you know, doing the hundreds is not going to hurt. It's really good because it's getting the circulation going. I'm not saying do jump board if you have an ankle sprain. I'm saying get the circulation going in the rest of your body. And that's one of the coolest things about Pilates that I get very passionate about, is that if I have a client with an injury, almost any injury, I can have them work out through it because it's very easy to adapt. You tell me how many people in a gym can have their client with a broken foot still work out, because most of the stuff, it's weight-bearing on the feet or something, and it doesn't really work. I've had clients with broken elbows, broken ribs, broken feet, broken, I mean, you name it. And they've been able to not miss a beat because I can work around the injury and make sure the injury does not get more injured, but yet they're still getting the circulation, which speeds up the healing. So that's not what you're asking about, but I'm just throwing that out there. That's my thought. Again, as a Pilates instructor, we need to be very careful how we tread on giving our opinions of what they're doing or have already done, because there are the negative psychological impact of causing them to regret their choice that they've already done. Okay, so I'll leave that alone. You can think about that one. But, you know, if they've already done it, you know, you might want to talk to them if they're planning having more injections, because a lot of times with the cortisone, they do multiple rounds, or even the doctors will tell you, oh, you can't do more than X amount of cortisone injections. This is why, because it eats away and deteriorates your ligaments and tendons, and they know that. That to me, I don't want to do anything that there's a limit on, because, or how long I can take it or something like that, because that to me is saying that there's a negative that I need to watch out for, and that's just not worth it for me personally. Now, if I had the sciatica pain, I might feel different. I don't know. But personally, you know that I feel that sciatica pain is really caused by a muscle imbalance where, you know, whether it's a bursitis or sciatica pain, to me those are two different conditions. Well, she's getting the sciatica pain. That's a symptom of the bursitis. Why is the burst inflamed? There's a large component of research and information out there saying that all these inflammations really have a lot to do with food allergies and a lot of the chemicals that we intake, whether it's through our nose or our skin or our digestive system, that our body is reacting to, causing this inflammation. Or is it a muscle imbalance? They've got some really bad postural habits or different, you know, things going on in their body that cause their joints to be sitting wrong and causing friction where there shouldn't be friction and causing the irritation. So, you know, that's our specialty as Pilates instructors, but there is the other component that you might want to hint at. And to me, neither one of those things are being addressed with the prolotherapy. Yes, it might help that, but it's not actually solving the problem. Whether it's the cortisone or the prolotherapy, neither one of them are solving the problem. They're band-aiding it, and some of them are band-aiding it better than others. A band-aid that causes more problems is not a good band-aid, in my opinion. So that's my thought. I have a very strong passion for making sure you get to the root of it and figuring out why something is happening, not just trying to make it stop. Okay, to me, just making it stop is not good enough. It's not fixing the problem. And unfortunately, most of our doctors, that's the only thing they care about, is treating the symptoms. And I think we as clients, patients, we need to demand more. As Pilates instructors, we can encourage them to demand more. You know, why do I have this bursitis? I mean, you ask that to a doctor and they look at you like you're insane. They don't know. That's the question to be asking. That was a long-winded answer. Hopefully that wasn't too much. Okay, I'm going to tackle another question. Wow, this is another... Oh, loaded one. Okay, hi there. On the short box series, I've heard you're supposed to use your hamstrings to help pull you up and not only rely on the hip flexors. I don't feel my hamstrings working. The feeling could be overshadowed by my abs, of course. Smiley face. How do I get my hamstrings to work, and how would I cue this? Thanks. Well, you wouldn't feel this because your hamstrings are not supposed to do that. I don't have a nice way to say that. However, I will tell you a story. Okay, so way back when I was still dancing, my ballet teacher used to always say, lift your leg from your hamstrings. Use the back of your leg muscles to lift your leg high. And they're talking about doing extension where your leg, you know, is ideally trying to, you know, be pointed up to the sky, you know, so it's hitting you in the side of the face. Mine never did that, but that's the direction you're going. Okay, that is a lot of hip flexion. I mean, you're trying to flex your hip as much as possible. How in the world are your hamstrings supposed to work? And this bothered me to no end. This came up at the time when I was dancing and I was going through my Pilates training and I'm studying anatomy and taking anatomy. I'm like, this makes absolutely no sense. How in the world, when I'm doing as much hip flexion as possible, are my hip extensors supposed to be working? Why would they say that? It doesn't even make sense. And I kept talking and trying to figure it out. And here's my analysis. And since then, I have read in Karen Clippinger's book, The Dance Anatomy and Kinesiology, the same issue. Dancers tend to cue this, and what they're trying to say is their psoas. The psoas, if you remember, attaches down on the inside of the leg, on the lesser trochanter, so that when you're doing extension of the leg, that serious, it's called extension of the leg, but it's really raising your leg up into the air. It's the most hip flexion you could do. Feels like it's coming from like the inside kind of back of your thigh. It's your psoas. And the psoas is particularly strong hip flexor in 90 degrees and above versus like rectus femoris, which is the hip flexor that most people are dominant in, is more up to 90. Okay, so what the dancers are trying to get you to do is to cue into your psoas. Now, this works by saying your hamstrings for a lot of people. Obviously, for me, it did not work. It just made me want to put my head through the wall and confuse me to no end. But some clients, that works. I have found for me that I will cue, feel it from your inner thigh. A lot of times I'll deconstruct the movement and go back into like knee folds from the movement principle exercises and have them try to distinguish lifting the knee up from the psoas. And I'll, you know, explain where the psoas is and how, you know, it feels like it's your inner thigh and the adduction is one of the motions of the psoas and all that stuff. And put their fingers on their hip flexors, meaning the rectus femoris, not just all the hip flexors, and try to not have that bulge up under their fingers. And if they can do that, then they're going to have a much easier time when they get against gravity and stand up vertically. Now, in terms of the short box, I personally haven't heard anyone say their hamstrings will help you pull up, but again, this is ridiculous because the hamstrings are not working at all. Maybe the hamstrings might be working to help posteriorly tilt your pelvis if you're doing round back, but again, usually with that angle to gravity, your rectus abdominis is going to be doing the tucking under of the pelvis, the posterior tilt there, not the hamstrings as much there because you have the edge of the box like pushing into them. That it kind of works against them. So that's my thought. I think it comes from dance land, and it's one of those cues that is not anatomically correct. And I wouldn't try to cue my clients by saying that. A lot of clients would get confused and start thinking their hamstrings are on the front of their thighs or weird things like that because that's not the muscle they're supposed to feel and they're not going to. And most clients are not going to argue with you because they just think they're missing it and they're embarrassed that they're not getting it, if that makes sense. Which I love that you asked this question because you're not embarrassed to ask it. And I love that this is a forum that you can not be embarrassed to ask that because most people wouldn't ask that. They just think they're retarded. You're not retarded, and your abs should be the one that are working. So on the short box series, what you should be feeling is if you're doing round back, it should be rectus abdominis, so that deep, low burning because of what's being held still versus the 100 is a little different. It's more the upper part of the rectus abdominis. Again, those are separate little sheaths of muscles, and we group them all together, but you do have upper, middle, lower abs, so to speak, of that, as well as your hip flexors, meaning your psoas, particularly your psoas. Rectus femoris works too, but psoas is what you want, especially in the flat back one. Flat back, it's just hip flexion. That's all it is. You're working really hard to keep your spine straight and that length and that growing tall. Because you want to do it all from your hip flexors. And that's why you're allowed to do that exercise in pregnancy, because it's not rectus abdominis. You're not rounding your back. It's all hip flexors. That's why it's fine to do with osteoporotic clients. It is just hip movement. You see it in your mind's eye. You're just opening and closing that hip joint. The difference is that most of the time when we do hip flexion exercises, our torso holds still and our legs move away and towards our torso. This one, the opposite's happening. The legs are fixed, and the torso is moving away and towards. All right, so that's one of the things I love most about Pilates is that we do these movements, and we hold different ends of the muscle still. We change up our orientation both to gravity as well as how the movement's carried out, even though it's the same movement. And that that is cross-training in its essence right there. You're not doing the same thing all the time. You're using the same muscles. You're using them in different ways, different angles. So you might do triceps and do them like 10 different angles. So one with your arms out to the side, bending and straightening your elbows. One with your elbows forward. One with your arms overhead, like in shave the back of the head or salute. Versus, you know, out to the side, you're doing like the one-arm push-up on the barrels. Versus out in front of you, you know, maybe you're doing some different things on the tower. Versus behind you, versus like dips or long back stretch or something like that. There's all these different angles on that. Or elbows out pointed behind you, you know, pulling straps or the pull-ups and stuff. Most people just do it in like behind you. And so we do it so many different ways that's a great range of motion, different variety. It's going to lead to less injuries and much more muscle balancing. And you'll be able to see those imbalances better because when you get the body in different angles, it'll show up. Like, oh, whoa, that's the problem. Why is that different than here? And you start, you know, being a detective and figuring out. Okay, so that's my question, my answer. And again, I stand by it because I feel very validated in what I came up with because Karen Clippinger talks about that as well, and she specifically talks about the dance cueing and everything. So, interesting. again, a lot of the cues that people use in Pilates are not necessarily always accurate. Okay, so here's another one I'm going to finish with. Hi, Katrina. I've written to you about this client before. He's my fly-in, fly-out mining client who does a lot of deadlifting. Can you help me with the response to the following? He wrote to her, in addition, my coach wants me to not change my breathing pattern, parentheses, breathing into the ribs versus belly, as he feels it counterintuitive to what we are trying to achieve with the powerlifting program. He has also suggested that we lean towards a stretching and flexibility-based program. I think we do that anyways, but that is what he suggests. Would you be able to adapt your program to the above conditions? Let me know what you think. Well, yes, you are doing a stretching and flexibility-based program. And like I was talking about earlier, what you're doing is a lot of what I call sneaky stretching, where you are actively lengthening the muscle while contracting the opposing muscles. So, for example, and this might be a way to explain it to your client, let's talk about, say, the quads. So the quads extend the knee, straighten the leg, meaning, and the hamstrings flex the knee, bend the knee. And so if you are trying to stretch the hamstrings, one thing you can do is to work the quads, all right? If you are trying to stretch the quads, one thing you can do is work the hamstrings, and they work in opposition. Now, usually if you are trying to stretch the quads and you're working the hamstring and trying to pull your heel, like, all the way to your butt and get that full range of motion, your hamstrings are going to be crying, and that's all you're going to notice. And that's why I call it sneaky stretching, because you don't feel that passive where your body is trying to overcome the stretch reflex and, quote, release into it, which most people feel when they do passive stretching. You miss all that. When you're doing active stretching and you're working the opposing muscles, it's a much longer results. You're going to change the actual resting length of the muscle over time working on that, and you're going to bring balance to the muscle joint. So by bringing balance to the muscle joint, the joint's going to sit where it needs to sit, and the beautiful thing about that is there's going to be less wear and tear on the joint, which is going to prevent any of the itis, inflammation issues, as well as potential injuries. So you are doing a flexibility program. You are definitely strengthening, but the stretching and flexibility is part of it. You just don't notice it because you get the strengthening as well. So this is what I call multitasking. And I think that's why women love it so much, because you don't have to go and stretch at the end. Now, a lot of instructors do put some passive stretches at the end, mainly because the clients bully them into it because they think they need to do that, and they've been so conditioned by all the fitness stuff they read that they think they have to do that. There's absolutely no need to do extra passive stretches at the end of a Pilates session, okay? It is a stretching and flexibility-based program. Okay, in terms of the breathing, back to, you know, what you learned in the P3 program and your basic training modules, the breathing is very closely tied into your core. And so the core that people talk about, you know, core conditioning and all that stuff, is made up of your transverse abdominis, that deep corset, you know, your internal weight belt, if you want to call it that, that pulls everything in. It doesn't create any movement. It just suctions everything in to stabilize your spine, along with your your lumbar multifidus, which are the little muscles in between your vertebrae that plump up when they're working with the transversus to create space between the vertebrae. And that's going to help prevent the compression of your spine. Now, on the top of your core, you have the diaphragm, and on the bottom, you have your pelvic floor. And that's how the breath pertains into it. When you're breathing, if your diaphragm bellows down into your abdominal cavity, it will push your belly out. And that's what we call the belly breathing. If you're doing that, you're pushing on that belly out, you're not going to get the same decompression in the spine. So if you're doing something, especially like powerlifting, where there's a lot of weight and pressure pressing down on the spine, you definitely want that core connection so that you don't cause any disc injuries or spinal injuries. And you absolutely need that core connection. So belly breathing would be completely inappropriate, in my opinion, anatomically. Now, the ribcage breathing, what it's doing is it's going to allow you to breathe in a different way without having to have the diaphragm bellow down into the abdominal cavity. It holds still, and the ribs move to intake the air by opening up in the muscles, the intercostals that run in between the ribs. And they stretch out and allow that extra volume to come into the lungs so you can get the air in while you're breathing, without compromising the stability of your back. Plus, bonus, your abs look better. So keeping your belly pulled in while you're breathing and doing exercises is essential. Now, even if he doesn't understand fully how belly breathing would be detrimental to the core and possibly compromise the back stability, here's the thing. Your ribcage breathing you're teaching him is just giving his body another choice. It's going to be working on opening up his rib cage, which is going to give him more mobility in his upper torso and more ability to rotate in particular and side bend, rotate especially. I can't tell you how many golfers that have their rib cage locked up. They take so much extra movement then in their low back and their shoulders to get that crazy range of motion in the golf swing. It's really hard on their low back and their shoulders. What injuries do you see in golfers right there? If, you know, getting that extra range of motion can really help open things up and disperse that extra force and range of motion on the body. So in terms of powerlifting, it's not going to hurt the powerlifting. It's going to help and give you more choices. To me, the beautiful thing about Pilates is that you are giving the body choices. You are training the body so that it has more choices and it can choose the best choice neurologically in the moment when it comes up to something. Oh, a ball is being thrown at me, a car is coming at me. I can choose because I have more neurological pathways and more movement options and more strength and flexibility to get out of the way and not get hurt, kind of a thing, versus if you always do it one way, you don't have those options. So hopefully that makes sense, and I would talk to them and explain to him. It sounds like your client is a very intelligent person and wants to understand. I would explain to them about the breathing into the ribs versus the belly and why you want to do one versus the other. Belly breathing is not bad. It's not going to hurt you. But if you're doing something that is going to be needing the abdominals, meaning needing the core stability, I would not do belly breathing. That's not going to be it. So in Pilates, we do the breathing into the ribs because we do so much core work and so much ab work where you don't want to be fighting your body. You know, if your breath is trying to go into your abs and your abs are trying to pull in to stabilize your core, guess which one's going to win? Your body is designed so that it will always let the air coming in win. Air is essential. You've got to be breathing. The back stability, not so much. I would argue that it's really important to have your back be stable, but in terms of life and death, your body is going to choose air, and so your back will be compromised, and that's what we want to focus on, is making sure that the back is protected. I'm not sure what training the coach the powerlifting coach has. I don't know the mechanics. I'm not a powerlifter, and what they do train, whether they hold the breath, they push out, they pull in, I don't know. I do know that a lot of people wear weight belts to kind of act as an external version of their transverse abdominis. Again, ideally, you wouldn't need that kind of a thing. I know that they lift so much that they need extra help, but the getting the core so strong that you don't need it, at least in lifting regular amounts of weight, should be an option so that you can use your core instead of having to have external help. All right, so if you have other questions, or if your client, when you give this information to him and explain it to him, has questions, please feel free to contact me and follow up. If anybody else listening has a question, please feel free to email me and let me know, and I would be happy to follow up. I will say that you want to tread carefully. From what you've said, this person's passion is powerlifting for whatever reasons. Everybody's got their own thing they love. And if you start bashing their coach or going against them, they may, if they don't understand where you're coming from, they may start to distrust you. So you want to be careful and proceed with caution and proceed respectfully, I guess would be the best way. This may not be something that they've heard about. It may not be the way that most powerlifters do things. That doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It just means that you might be giving them new information and they might not be open to it. You never know. So just some thoughts. I wish you luck with that, and I just want to encourage everyone out there. You guys have some great questions. Send the questions on in, whether it's about a specific client or if it's about a more general topic. This is a great example, this last question, because this is a very specific client, but yet this happens a lot. I can't tell you how many times I've had a client where their PT sends me a message, or their personal trainer sends me a message, or their chiropractor sends me a message or something of what they want me to do with them. And of course, all of them have a different view of what the client needs, and that's fine, but you need to proceed with respect and caution in how you handle it, so that we want to be respectful of that other healthcare professional's stomping ground, so to speak, but yet, you know, we need to hold firm to the Pilates integrity of what we're doing. I would never suggest letting somebody do belly breathing while they're doing Pilates, because it would compromise their core and it would be completely against what Pilates is all about, and they wouldn't get any benefits. So it wouldn't do them any good. I would feel like I was doing somebody harm. And again, we don't want to do anybody harm. I know all of you have such good spirits, but at the same point, you want to educate them about the issue and let them decide, because it's their body, you know, what they want to do in that situation. I believe very, very strongly, as you guys all know, with all the value-adding lectures that we've talked about and how to educate your clients, that educating your clients only leads to better things. When your client understands why they're doing things and what's going to happen when they do this, and the mechanics behind it, you know, as they can understand it, you know, in words they understand. We don't have to use technical terms, but they are excited about it. They're more empowered. They can make better decisions, because face it, you don't get to walk around with them every day and hold their hand and make sure they do this and that right. You know, you have to let them go like a mama. Go along, little chicks, and hopefully I trained you well. So that's your job as a Pilates instructor, and I know you take it very seriously, or you wouldn't be listening. So have a great night. Send me those questions, and remember that everyone deserves to enjoy movement. So help your clients and help them understand that they can and will enjoy movement when they start moving correctly. Have a great night. Thanks.